This is Suzanne Backner. I am a writer, director, and the artistic director of JMTC Theater.
Hi, this is Bob Brader, and I'm the executive director of JMTC Theater.
We're talking to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Days Gone By. Mazel tov.
Oh, shalom, damn it! This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And you know, I do love me some theater. I love the creative people, the playwrights, the actors, and even people who run theater companies. And boy, oh boy, we're hitting the trifecta on that today, because we're talking to two people, married people. They are the artistic directors of John Montgomery Theater Company, or now they call it JMTC. And this is really cool, because in January, they're doing three different one-person shows that the two of them have created. We're talking about Bob Brader and Suzanne Backner, and they're with us on the telephone, and shalom to you both!
Shalom!
There you go. Is that the one Jewish word you both know?
But no, Suzanne knows a lot of them. I'm learning.
Oh, so wait. Suzanne, are you of the tribe?
I am a member of the tribe. Bob is an honorary member.
He's an honorary member. He's Jewish by injection, in a manner of speaking, or reverse injection, if you say. So, Suzanne, first, most important.
Well, I sometimes call him my goy boy, Rabbi, if that is not too offensive.
Oh, that's adorable. How long have you been married?
We just celebrated our 10 years of marriage.
Oh, mit mazel, mit glick! Bob, did you ever think about perhaps converting?
No.
and Suzanne has never forced that on me. I am loving learning, but I have never thought of converting.
Well, do you believe in the Jesus guy?
I am a very spiritual person, but not a majorly religious person.
Okay.
That's a good way to call it.
He had a little trouble with the Lutheran church as a boy.
Yes, growing up.
Is that part of one of the plays?
It used to be, but we actually took it out, because when you're constructing a play, you're hitting different marks, and that just made the play a little too expansive, so we really wanted to focus on the story that we were telling.
It's going to be in the book.
Yes, it will be in the book.
Well, no, tell us now. What happened with the Lutherans? What did they do to you?
Basically, I grew up that didn't have a whole lot of money. We were poor, and I did not dress the way that most of the other people that went to this church dressed. And really, specifically, my parents got me a Bible for Christmas. It was a Bible that had pictures in it, like what Jerusalem looked like then and what it looks like now. It was a very interesting Bible, but it was definitely a Bible. And I took it into my catechism classes, and the pastor looked at it and was like, "This is not a real Bible." And I was like, "Well, it is." And I got it for Christmas. My family got me this Bible, so to me, it was very real, and it had a very personal feel to it. And he kept insisting that I had to get one that was like everybody else's. And if you believe that your Bible is the same, you're wrong, and you don't belong here.
Ooh.
After he said that, I left, and I never went back.
The thing is, of course, with a Jewish Bible, it kind of has to be the same words. You can't be switching around
right.
The Hebrew. But you can have pictures in it. You can have pop-up stuff. You can have Delilah naked, even, if you're in there. Yeah. I wouldn't do scratch and sniff during the Tower of Babel segment, but other than that, there's tons of things you could do with a Jewish Bible. There you go. So, I didn't mention the name of the plays that are going to be done by the John Montgomery... Hey, actually, let me ask you another question. Why the hell did you change the name from John Montgomery Theater Company to JMTC? It's not even that memorable.
Well, the theater company was originally named after my first husband's dad, who had passed. He was English-Irish, and he encouraged John Montgomery Hillen, and he encouraged Patrick Hillen, my first husband and original partner in the theater company, to go to drama school when everyone was trying to send him to trade school and didn't see him as having potential to do creative things. So that's why the company was named after him. But in the years hence, it was like people kept asking, well, who's John Montgomery? They thought he was like this mentor of ours or some acting teacher. And when I was running the theater company on my own, it was sort of like, I don't know if you remember the show Remington Steele from the 80s, but it was sort of like that. John Montgomery became Remington Steele that I was, you know, hiding behind. And so people would call him and say, Remington Steele, but it was, you know, John Montgomery. And I, you know, I would have to say, well, I'd have to get a medium to contact him from the head to do that. And also you're sexist for thinking that, you know, anyway, so that got very old. And Patrick always called the company, like early on, we called it JMTC for short. So we finally decided that it was time to still honor the original John Montgomery, but call the company JMTC Theater. That was really short story.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm glad you mentioned Remington Steele because Stephanie Zimbalist is a Jewess, which always makes me happy. Daughter of Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. But I don't know. I mean, why not just call it B&B? Or would people confuse it with a place that they stay when they're out of town? Well, you know, Brager and Bachner, or some Brad Bach Theater, or the Bach Bra, something like that.
We are continuing on the tradition of the company, which has a long history, and so we're still honoring that past.
Well, what is the ethos, whether it's changed or not, or if it's kind of the same, of your company as opposed to other theater companies started by other people?
Well, in the past many years, we have really focused on art and advocacy. And it's always been a company that takes on original work and classics, but we've mostly been focusing on original work and partnerships with nonprofits, companies, organizations that tackle social issues and do good in the world. And the themes of our plays link with a lot of these companies' missions. So we've had these wonderful partnerships that we've been touring our work throughout the U.S. and Canada. So art and advocacy has been our focus, and that's really been the company's focus as well.
Well, what do you advocate specifically for?
Well, for my solo show, Spitting in the Face of the Devil, which is about growing up with an abusive father and sexual abuse and child abuse, we've been teaming up with a lot of different child abuse organizations as well as women's shelters at places like that. For the New York shows, we're teaming up with Safe Horizon, which is an incredible organization in New York City. Yeah, and they're incredible. And for Smoker, which is the other show that we're doing in New York about my 28-year love affair with smoking, we teamed up with places like the American Cancer Society and the Canadian Lung Association, any place that deals with the hazards of smoking and how bad it is for you.
So let's unpack this just so people can really get this straight. The three plays that are going to be running between January 2nd and January 13th are going to be, one of them is Spitting in the Face of the Devil, which is a solo show that Bob Brager does, and it's all about being abused by his sort of crazy Marine father. There's also Smoker, which is another show that Bob Brager wrote and performs about, as you said, your 29-year addiction and love of smoking. And then Suzanne has her own show called The Good Adoptee.
Because I am the only one that exists, the only good.
All right, well, since you bring that up, how are you a good adoptee?
Well, that is a term coined by E.F. Lipton, the wonderful writer and adoptee advocate. And she talked about good and bad adoptees. And so it's a little tongue-in-cheek because basically her theory is that in all adoptees, there exists the good and the bad adoptee. Because adoptees, we have this sort of dual identity. We have our original family and then our family of experience. You know, we have two completely different names. The one that we're given at birth on our birth certificates and our original birth certificates, and then the one we're raised with. So it gets very, very complicated, but there's always this duality going on.
But your play is about trying to find your birth parents and all the bureaucracy that you went up against. Is that what it is?
Yes, and it's really trying to find my origins and not just more who I am, not these people who exist, although, of course, I was looking for the people, too. And I was placed in a Jewish adoption agency that no longer exists in New York called Louise Wise. I don't know if you've heard of it.
No, I've heard of the Diskin Orphan Home. That was another one, but not Louise Wise.
Louise Wise was also the subject in part of the movie that came out, the documentary that came out this summer called Three Identical Strangers.
Ooh.
because they had twin studies, and actually that's something that I touch on in the play, because at one point I thought I was part of these twin studies where they separated twins. And so when you don't know your origins, you don't know if you happen to have a twin that's just wandering around, and that's part of the journey. It's kind of like a gripping mystery as I'm trying to find my origins, my birth parents, who I am. You know, did I just get shot put from an alien planet here? You know, these things are things that kind of gnaw at you.
Well, here's a question, though. It's like they make it bureaucratically difficult, near impossible, but they do that, I assume, for a reason. I mean, you have two different sides to protect. Three, really, because you've got you and then your new family and your first one, yeah.
There aren't really two different sides here there are two different sides, but these are very antiquated laws that were made, and I will say with good intentions, back in the 30s and 40s to protect adoptees from bastard status. This is when there was such a thing that we called like an unwed mother. This was pre-Roe v. Wade, baby scoop era, where we thought, oh, single parents can't raise children properly and all of that kind of stuff. This is very ancient kind of thinking. That's not really the way it is. This is the era of closed adoption, when we thought that secrets and lies were a good thing, which we don't anymore. So a lot of people who are wanting to cling to the old way of doing things and keep everything secret often call upon, like they say, oh, we promise birth mothers or first mothers anonymity and protection in that way, but that is an L-I-E. That's just not true.
Like a Long Island expression? Oh, yeah, okay. But again, there are, I'm sure, some mothers and parents who do this happens, and they want to adopt the child. And really, it'd be nice to know that the child ended up being alive and going to a nice family and doing well, but they really don't want to be reminded 25, 30 years later of that moment in their lives. How do you protect that?
It's not really a valid protection when, you know, this is basically a civil rights, human rights issue where most of the population has access to their original birth certificate, but adopted citizens who pay taxes, do all the citizenry things, do not have that same right. So it's really a matter of adoptee inequality. And we want adoptee equality. We want equality for all, Rabbi.
This I believe in.
Jewish girl.
Let me ask you, nice Jewish girl that you are, they didn't have this when you first started looking and doing your search, but have you done the ancestry thing, the 23andMe?
I have not. Very complicated. That's another reason why these laws are so draconian and outdated, because with Ancestry.com and 23andMe and all of these things, which, you know, people just do because they want, because they're interested. People do this as hobbies, not because they're searching for their very existence, and, you know, very high stakes when adoptees are doing it. But basically, there is no privacy. I think that we're learning now that there is no privacy in general. So an antiquated law in the books that was perhaps well-intentioned way back when is not useful now, because what happens with an adoptee search, like I searched a while ago before all of this came out, so I was doing different methods. But if I was searching now, I would do Ancestry. I would do all of that genealogical stuff.
Sure. And also, you want to find a lot of people. Yeah. You say it's just a hobby, but there are people who go, they're looking to see if they're going to get Tay-Sachs, you know, if they're predisposed to hangnail. They want to know these things.
Right. Yeah. But I didn't mean to minimize the stakes for everyone doing these sorts of things. But basically, if I, like, let's say I got a hit on a cousin, on a first cousin, and then that led me to a first parent, meaning a birth parent. This is not a private way. If my first parent, my first mom, wanted complete privacy and never, you know, did not tell her family that she had a kid way back when and relinquished the child for adoption, and it was like a secret in her family, she would be outed by all of these extended family members who happen to do Ancestry.
Mm, fair enough.
Happen to get a hit. So these antiquated, non-equality, really draconian laws on the book can't actually protect birth parents or first parents from being found and can't, they don't actually honor their privacy. The searches happen on both sides. I mean, there are many first parents who search for their kids.
Oh, sure.
And 98%, this is approximate, but about 98% of people want to have some kind of contact or, you know, not necessarily a relationship, but just to know that their kid is okay.
I want to know if there's a serial killer back in my family. Because I just figure somewhere, my personality is somewhere in. So I don't want to ruin the suspense of your play for people, Suzanne Bachner, but is there a resolution? You met your mom, you had a dinner with the old family or not or what, but did things get resolved at this point?
I will just tell you, I have to switch the subject for 1 second.
Okay.
And this is just the person who is delivering that resolution or dramatic story in a satisfying way, which is that I do not perform the show. I'm the writer and director of the show.
It is all right.
Stories, Bob's stories, or history stories. But we have a colleague and dear friend who is an incredible actress named Anna Bridgeforth who performs the show. Anna Bridgeforth.
And is performing in your...
When Anna has a story in her hands to tell on stage, and I've been very lucky to be able to have her tell on her own in this case, but with an ensemble of actors in other cases with other projects, when Anna is delivering a story, the audience leaves incredibly satisfied.
Oh, good. Okay.
Maybe that's because I don't suck as a storyteller, too.
Well, no, you've had other plays, by the way. We should mention that, I don't know if they were for JMTC, but you did Circle, which was kind of an off-Broadway hit a few years back.
It was an off-Broadway hit, actually.
Oh, wow, excuse me. Off-Broadway hit.
Yeah.
Was that like a La Ronde thing, an adaptation of that?
It is inspired by La Ronde, but it is not a strict adaptation of it. It is much more focused on sex, power, intimacy, and desire, which I tend to write about. And there are gay, lesbian, bisexual characters in it. It's not a strict adaptation, but it's definitely inspired by La Ronde completely. And we also toured that throughout the U.S. and Canada, and we did a two-actor version, and Bob was one of those two actors.
Bob Brader, he's there too. Now we're going to get to talk to him. He is, as we say, the co-artistic director of JMTC, which is doing these three plays, Spitting in the Face of the Devil, The Good Adoptee, and Smoker. They're all in repertory January 2nd through January 13th at Shetler Studios. This is in Midtown. It's on West 54th Street. So, Bob, shalom to you, by the way.
Hi.
You're waiting so patiently there. So let's talk about your two different plays. First of all, Spitting in the Face of the Teufel, meaning your father, who was charismatic, but also kind of a wound-up, uptight Marine who was abusive, yes?
Yes. He was incredibly abusive. It was also later that I found out that he was also a predator. He molested two of my friends, as well as my uncle, at very young ages. I found out in ninth grade. So the story is really about finding out a lot of these secrets and then what happens after you find out about this stuff that is going on.
Well, first of all, how did you, because nobody talked about this stuff back in the day, so how did you find out that your dad was doing things to other young boys?
It was actually his own demise. And what he actually did was he came to me one day, and I had my best friend Richard, and Richard and I were like really, really close. We were really best friends. And my father came to me one day, and he said, you know, your friend Richard is gay. And I was like, what are you talking about? Of course he's not gay. He's my best friend. If he was gay, I would know. And he was like, no, really, he's gay. He told me, and he confided in me. And I was like, hold it. How could my best friend confide in this person who I'm not even that close with? So I went to Richard and I said, Richard, last night, my father, so like of all people, told me that you were gay. And I was like, you know that you could tell me anything and I would still be your friend and it wouldn't bother me. And if it's true, like why would you keep this a secret? And so he sat down and he told me this story about my father. And it was jaw-dropping about how he molested my friend David when he was really young and how he went after my uncle when he was also really young, 10 years old actually, and how he went after Richard when he was about 13. And my jaw dropped to the floor. I couldn't believe it.
Sounds like a lot of jaws were dropping during this whole period, but no, I'm kidding. just couldn't resist that. I'm sorry. But did your dad want to be found out by you? Was this sort of his passive-aggressive way of saying, hey, by the way, I like him young and male?
way of trying to get me not to be friends with Richard anymore, because Richard said that he wasn't going to do anything with my father anymore.
Oh.
My father, he told Richard had found some friends of his that were more his age, and he was getting along with them, and they were exploring together and doing things together, and so he didn't want that kind of attention from my father anymore, and so he told my father that he wasn't going to do anything with him anymore, and my father wanted to then make sure that Richard didn't come over to the house anymore. So since he was the bully, he felt that after he told me that Richard was gay, of course, I wouldn't hang out with him anymore.
So let me ask you a question, though. I mean, again, this, I don't want to take away the end of your play there, Springing in the Face of the Devil, but did you ever get to, was your father ever punished either for being a molester or being of you an abuser?
Like most abusers at that time, my father got away scot-free.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long did he...
He did lose his family.
Oh, okay.
He did lose all of us. But he was never criminally prosecuted for anything that he ever did.
The community rallied around him.
And yes, I mean, everybody that my mom and I tried as hard as we could to get people to be on our side and to get people to back us against him, and nobody would, because he was very charismatic, and everybody loved my father. So it was a really, really difficult time for my mother and I, because no one believed us. My mom's parents, who she went to numerous times to try and get help, and they were like, I just don't believe this is going on. So they didn't help us at all.
Wow. Now, was your father abusive physically to your mom or just you?
I was the brunt of his anger. He was verbally abusive to my mom, but never physically abusive. I think he got that all out on me.
And she was terrified.
She was terrified of him. He didn't have to hit her in order to get what he wanted. All he had to do was yell, and she would do whatever he asked her to do. But for me, he wanted to constantly show me that he was the one who was in charge. So if you asked for something the wrong way, if you weren't polite enough, if you weren't clean enough, if you whatever reason, you could get smacked or punched or whatever.
What gave her finally the gumption to grab you and pick up and try and get away from him? As you said, he eventually lost the family, so she was able to divorce him?
Well, my mom grew up in an abusive household, so in her mind, a lot of this was very normal. You know, and so because she grew up that way, and my grandfather was abusive, so she saw that her whole childhood. So she saw this as a normal thing. It wasn't until everything came out and Richard told us everything that was going on and we found out all of this stuff that my mom and I realized that we needed to get out. And we saved up a whole lot of money. It took us about 2 years. We were in that house for 2 years after we found out what he was doing and what he did.
Yeah.
Before we could actually get the money to move out.
And did you ever see him again after the day that you left?
Well, yeah, because we left, and then I felt that I needed to move away and get away from that town and get away from that area.
Sure.
And my mom and sister went back to him. My mom couldn't figure out a way to survive and be on her own. And my father came to her, and again, with his charismatic way, convinced her that he was going to change and that things were going to be different. So she went back to him.
Now, are they, a horrible way of putting this, are they both dead? Are they alive? Where are they now?
My father died in 2003 of a heart attack. I had not seen him in 10 years, over 10 years.
Yeah. And your mama?
But my mom is still alive, as well as my sister. We're all very, very close, and they live in Pennsylvania.
Mazel McGlick. Okay, so all right, at least some healing was able to...
Yes, and they did eventually leave him.
Oh, again, the second time?
Yep, they left the second time.
Oh, good for that. I mean, your sister had to be of age, of 18, 19, and then go, but...
My sister had a totally different relationship with my father than I did. I mean, my sister could say anything and do anything, and my father just let it go. He never hit her. Not until she started dating. When she started dating is when he kind of turned on her and said that she was going to be a whore and she was going to be pregnant by the time she was
This is so weird. And it's almost like deja vu because there's an interview on the Dave's Gone By program that they're on right now with a woman named Romola Hodes. I don't know if you've ever heard of her. Do you know her?
No.
She is also a Jewess, and she is the daughter of one of the kingpins, as it were, of 42nd Street during the bad old days of the peep shows and the live sex acts and whatever. So her father was this very rich man, very charismatic man, but he was unbelievably abusive to her. So many of the things that I'm hearing from you, it's so weird, are in a conversation that we just aired on Dave's Gone By. It's very strange. You should listen to it, because it'll almost be like PTSD deja vu for you too. The pattern is the same. Yeah, it's literally, it's like the same behavior. It's very, very strange. But and rather terrible. But let me ask you also, Bob Brager, so that is the gist of Spitting in the Face of the Devil, your relationship with this charismatic, abusive, horrible father guy. But then you have another entirely different one-person show that you're doing called Smoker. And I can understand, considering what you came from and the misery that you endured, why you would turn to cigarettes as a way to relax, as something to have, it's a comfort thing. But it's 29 years now. Why do you still smoke?
Oh, I don't. I quit.
Oh!
That's what the whole thing was about. It's about my struggle to quit. It's about quitting.
I thought it was a love affair show about how wonderful cigarettes are, despite the terrible things people say about them. Oh!
No, it's about my love affair with smoking, but it's how we broke up.
So how long have you been clean from that?
Since about 10 years.
Oh, mit mazel, mit. So wait. Suzanne, did you get him to stop? Was that the deal?
I don't get anyone to do anything. I mean, being a director in theater, I learned that you don't get anyone to do anything.
I opened the show. The show opens with Suzanne and I in a couple's therapy session. Not because we're having problems in our relationship, but because we were learning about communication. Suzanne was worried that she had some problems with communication with her last boyfriend and maybe a little with her husband. So she was like, I want to have open communication. So we were in this couples therapy session where we're talking about communication. And the therapist...
I did drag him into that. To be fair, I did drag him.
Not my scene a lot, but it was interesting. And the therapist said, do you have any concerns within the relationship? And Suzanne said, I want to talk about Bob smoking. And I was furious.
Ooh.
Because the guy leading this couple's therapy was this really thin, really healthy guy, never smoked a cigarette in his life. Suzanne never smoked a cigarette in her life. She had no idea what it was like. So I was like, oh, I'm about to get pounced on.
But just to be fair to me, like, honestly, I did not go into that session thinking that I was going to bring up smoking at all. It just that we were talking, and I was, and sort of this deep-seated thing in me where I said, oh, I'm worried about Bob smoking, sort of just came up. I didn't expect to address that at all.
And for me,
it wasn't a trap.
Yeah.
And for me, it felt like Suzanne doesn't love me.
Oh, okay.
Suzanne can't accept me for who I am. I'm a smoker. And Suzanne knows that about me, but she can't accept it. And so to me, it was a total attack on me. And really, in trying to quit, I realized just how connected I was to that persona of the smoker. Also, going back to the other show, smoking is the only connection I ever had with my father. And it's the only thing we ever really did together.
Oh, boy.
And so when I was losing that, when I was breaking away from smoking, it was also the last connection that I had with my father.
You're lucky in a way that you didn't go to hard drugs or turn to other things, but I guess that connection with your dad started it in a way, and then it was time to finally give it up. I'm glad you did.
Yes, and I do talk a little bit about some of the days where I did try smoking marijuana. That's in the show. I was an unsuccessful marijuana smoker. I talk about...
Have you tried edible latkes? It's very, you put a sprinkle in there. Oh, it's,
that sounds good.
Yeah, tell me about it. So let me ask also, let's move back to Suzanne Bachner and your show, The Good Opti, which doesn't deal, or maybe it does deal with that other aspect, because it's interesting that, Bob, you had a father who was abusive to you and molested other people, and Suzanne, you dealt with sexual molestation, but not from your dad.
I actually am a survivor of sexual abuse, but that is not dealt with in this play.
Is there another play in the offing, or you're not touching that for theater?
No, I've written extensively about it in theater, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but just not in this play. I mean, I have a play called Alexander Triptych, where I talk about it, and also We Call Her Benny, which is a play that Anna Bridgeforth, who's in The Good Adoptee, and Bob was also, were in together in a 10-person ensemble, and that's actually a play about bipolar disorder and sexual abuse and adoption and connections around those two things, because sometimes I think adoptees are a little more vulnerable to predators because we have so many issues with coming into the world and being displaced into another entirely different family and then wanting to belong, wanting to not having genetic mirroring with our families and just wanting to, for our own survival, fit in and belong. And so then we have that kind of socially throughout our lives. And a predator can pick that up a mile away. It needs, you know, it's not that the kid is in love, but that the kid wants to belong. And so there's a vulnerability there. So that's something that we told the story about more in We Call Her Benny.
Now, also, I mean, you've mentioned bipolarity. Is that an autobiographical aspect, too, or is that just something else for that play?
No, that play is actually sort of, We Call Her Benny a memoir play, but it has some magical realism. There's a character who is the embodiment of my parents' first child, who they lost with a stillborn child, who I wouldn't have been in the family and adopted into the family had he survived, and how sort of he haunts me as this figure, and actually one of my best friends in the entire world, Frances O'Flynn, played him and in the original production, and it was very healing to kind of have that story told.
You know, people ask why Hashem gives people so much misery and sad stuff in their lives. It's basically so we can make art. I figure that's got to be the reason. Why do bad things? Why does the Holocaust happen so Spielberg can make Schindler's List? There's no way. Maybe that's the actual connection here. And I want to remind people that they can see your plays here. You've got two by Bob Brager, Spitting in the Face of the Devil and Smoker, running in repertory with The Good Adoptee, which is written by Suzanne Bachner and performed by Anna Bridgeforth. These are all happening January 2nd through the 13th in repertory, which means, you know, one day might have two different plays in it on a weekend, and then, you know, you have to check the calendar to see when they're running. As a matter of fact, to do that, go to JMTCINC.com. I told you should change the fucking name of this play. JMTCINC. Come on!
It's actually JMTC Theater with an RE.com.
Oh, that's better. That's a little better. JMTC Theater.com for the schedule of these three plays from JMTC Theater Company, which are playing at the Shetler Studios, which is over between like 7th and 8th Avenue and West 54th Street in Manhattan. But, Bob, I've got to ask you another question about not one of the plays that you're running, but one that certainly intrigues me, given my various medical problems over the years. What was
I hope we know what you're going to say.
Oh, what the hell was Preparation Hex?
Preparation Hex was it's absolutely the story of how I met and fell in love with Suzanne Bachner.
Oh.
Interspliced with the story of a debilitating hemorrhoid I had.
Seriously? Oh, I'm so sorry I never got to see this. Oh.
So basically, really, and this is absolutely true story, I was getting ready to do the first shows of Spitting in the Face of the Devil, and I think I was so stressed and so freaked out about doing that show, I got a hemorrhoid. It was massive. I mean, it was like a golf ball or a grapefruit.
No, it was not a grape. Come on, let's not exaggerate it. A golf ball is good enough. All right.
She saw it. I didn't. What's the difference? It was like a peach.
All right, that's
all
fair
I
enough.
All I know is I had to cancel a show because of it. I've performed with pneumonia, performed with sprained ankles and sprained wrists. I've performed with all different kinds of ailments, and I never had to cancel a show before except for this hemorrhoid, which was incredibly painful. It really was one of the most painful things I ever had. You never realize how many times you clench in a day.
Oh, I realize it. Oh, I'm clenching constantly, believe me. Jews know this. So wait a minute. So how long did you endure this horrible hemorrhoid?
The show takes it for 7 days. So it was 7 days long.
Oh.
Or it ruptured. They said it ruptured on its own.
Oh, thank God.
But I went in to the doctor. And I was laying on my side, and the doctor was looking at it. And he was like, he actually said, "Hold on a minute, I want to get a couple of my colleagues to come in and take a look at this." So I had like a couple doctors coming in to see this massive hemorrhoid that I had. I was like a science exhibit.
The title—it was very flattering.
Yeah, it was.
Just as it was flattering to have a play about the love story about me and Bob, and I was the leading lady in it. I was so excited. And then I said, you know, I think the hemorrhoid is actually the main character and not me. I think the hemorrhoid is the leading lady and not me.
Well, maybe it was metaphorical. It is you, but it's represented by this beautiful growth on his tuchus. that is part of. So is it all? It went completely away. Do you still have a little a cyst there? How's your ass doing?
My ass is doing great. I've not had a problem since.
And you know what? I'm going to suggest a business proposition to you, since you guys have a theater company. You should, after you're doing these three plays, think about a double bill of Preparation Hex and my friend Dave's The Miracle of Long Johns, if you know that play or if you've ever... Watch the show. It's on you. You'll see what happens in that show, and it would make an absolutely perfect double bill. I'm telling you, I'm just throwing that out there to you.
I love it.
Oh, it's wonderful stuff. Now, let me ask him, before we let you guys go, Bob Brader and Suzanne Bachner, were you colleagues first and romantic second? Or how did it evolve since you co-run a theater company, but you're also husband and wife?
Right, and I also want to tell you that with these three shows, they really are this collaboration.
Yeah.
So Bob's stories are his stories. He writes and performs them, and my story is my story. But Bob is the dramaturg of The Good Adoptee, and certainly inspired The Good Adoptee in terms of his amazing and honest, brave, bold, fearing, incredible storytelling.
Sure.
As I was doing more, as I said, I was sort of going into the memoir-esque. But then I said, well, for this story, I have to do a completely true story. And that was an inspiration from Bob. But I'm also Bob's director, so for his show
and developer.
So our hearts are in all of these shows together.
Oh, sure.
In this lovely way. But we met first. I saw Bob on stage at the Crane Theater in the show. He was in a company, and he was... in headline all of the plays for this company, and finally I went to see him, and he was this nasty, evil prick character in a play called Bitch, the Scottish play, and I was like, wow, that guy is just a prick and so powerful and charismatic. I think he might have been channeling his father in this character. And then I met him after the show, like on the steps of the Crane. It's like this brownstone, and we met on the steps. And I was like, oh my God, he is so friendly and lovely. He's a good actor.
All right. And then was there also a spark of, like, I might want to date this person?
Well, that didn't happen until we went to Disney World. The theater company that I was involved in was planning a trip to Disney World, and Suzanne and her boyfriend came along, and we were all a group wandering all over Disney, and then Suzanne and I wanted to take this tour, the MGM Backlot tour, which back then when Hollywood Studios was actually MGM Studios, and we took this tour, and it was ridiculous, and we were laughing the whole entire time, and then we went over to this coffee shop and sat down to have a cup of coffee and talk, and I fell for Suzanne like a ton of bricks. Right then, I knew right then that she was someone that I wanted to be with. It took Suzanne a little while to realize that she wanted to be with me, but I knew right then.
We call that our Sparkiversary.
Oh, I mean, I hope your ex-boyfriend isn't listening, but he probably has another thing he wants to call it, but it was meant to be. It was best shared. It's like, yeah, this is the when my ex-girlfriend shits on me anniversary. Yeah, how wonderful. Yeah, I'll have a latte. We've been talking with Bob Rader and Suzanne Bachner of JMTC, and go see. They do have an overall title, by the way, for these, because we keep calling them separately. Spitting in the Face of the Devil, The Good Adoptee, and Smoker. They're all in rep. Do you have an umbrella title for the whole thing? Kind of makes life easier.
We call it Three from JMTC.
Three from JMTC. Find out more about that at JMTC Theater. com, and remember that's theater, R-E, theater.com. You really should spend $15 and get the other URL, you know. Just buy it. You know, you could do theater.com. It'll cost you $15. You know, you have to go through this. But anywho, it's running January 2nd.
It's a very good idea.
Yeah, through the 13th at Schettler Studios on West 54th Street. But my other question, I'm always asking about this, since I'm Jewish and obsessed with money. You run a theater company, an off-Broadway theater company, right? How do you survive as people? I mean, do you have day jobs? Do you do other things? Do you have creative side jobs? Or are you literally, through grants and whatever, are you able to make enough to live in New York, of all places, running a theater company?
We have side hustles.
Yeah, we have side hustles. But, you know,
I do freelance directing as well.
Yeah.
We do lots of things.
Yeah, I did with Smoker, I was doing a smoking cessation program out and doing that show for a while.
A 60-minute version with LifeStage.
Yeah.
It's a great company.
LifeStage was amazing. We keep performing and keep plugging and do whatever we can.
Right, well, I mean, I'm just saying, it's like your side hustles, even those are directing, they're acting, they're not, I have to go work in an office for 3 months.
Right. I mean, we try to avoid that whenever as much as we possibly can and try and keep the side hustles going and try and find work wherever we can. I mean, we used to tour a lot and that brought in good money. Mm. And we'll probably be doing some of that in the future. Yeah. So, you know, whatever we can.
And the last question for you guys is, you're doing Three from JMTC right now, but what's on the burner, let's say, for springtime or summer? What's your next big project for the company itself?
Well, I'm working on a new play called Conversations with My Divorce Attorney, and I've had to tell my mother-in-law that this is not about her son.
Okay.
I posted it on Facebook, and she went nuts. and Bob is working on the book version,
Spitting in the Face of the Devil.
Oh, so you're going to turn that into a full, an actual biography, memoir, as it were.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to read it, and I can't wait to see all three of the plays that you guys are doing as part of Three from JMTC, Spitting in the Face of the Devil, Smoker, and The Good Adoptee. featuring the works of Suzanne Bachner and Bob Brader. It just remains for me to say thank you so much. It's been a delight having you in the neighborhood. I wish you much more creativity and success. And if you want, you know, a better name than JMT, I'm sorry, it's still so hard to remember JMTs. Think of something Jewish. Call it, I don't know, Gewalt.com. The Gewalt Theater. Think about it. Just or name it after Golda Meir. It's a thought.
There we go. Well, thank you so much. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
What a blast. Thank you.
Likewise, and shalom to you both.
Shalom.